I feel weird about this topic somehow. Like I...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like you feel like you don't have a solid idea.
Oh, I've got lots of ideas. I've got lots of ideas. And some of the categories, actually, it's going to be hard for me to just pick one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I already did my picking, except for in one category, but... Yeah.
I'm not... Don't worry. I'm not going to, like, list five things for each category, but...
Okay, good.
It was hard. It was hard.
But you... What? You feel like the approach is weird? Like, we're not going to have enough... We're not going to be able to talk enough about...
That's never been an issue, though, so...
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and with me is Alan Sutterby.
Hi.
Hi, Alan. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it, and we're going to talk about something right now. What do you think that something is, Alan?
Is the name of the episode Childhood Tasting Menu?
I mean, a little peek behind the curtain. Usually, like, the name of the episode might last from what I've called it in our recording app until it winds up being published, but there's a good chance along the way that it will get altered.
Okay. Yeah. We're talking about childhood food memories. That's what today's about. Yeah.
So, and we have kind of a framework, a fun approach,
a conceit.
I don't know what to call it. A conceit. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That's good. Do you want to talk about what the conceit is, Alan?
Can you do that?
Sure.
It was your idea, and I want to make sure that I understand it actually.
Okay. Yeah. That's a great idea. Okay. So the conceit is that, we are, making, maybe I don't understand it. Okay. The conceit is it's a tasting menu with what, eight courses, and each course is meant to inspire a childhood food memory, one from Alan and one from me. Which, as we both now know, it's incredibly difficult to pick.
So
the meal is going to be snack, then soup, then salad, main course, pasta, palate cleanser, dessert, and then after dinner cocktail.
Can I interject right there?
Yeah, please.
Why does the pasta come after the main?
The ordering of that particular course was inspired by Italian multi-course menus that I've had.
And they serve the pasta after... Like, isn't
like, yes,
the pasta is the primi piatti, is the first plate, and then the secondi is the meat, right?
Like, it goes... Well, it depends how many courses you're being served, and it also really depends. Okay, so I had a meal in La Cinque Terre at a restaurant called Dal Billy. It's an amazing seafood restaurant on the Mediterranean coast, and the meal that I had there was main first, pasta after. So it was snacks followed by main course, followed by pasta, followed by salad, followed by dessert.
Okay, you know what? Okay, I'm going to insist that is not traditional Italian, not the traditional Italian progression. However, I've definitely seen it before. And in fact, in one of the famous quotes of... Briat Savarin, who wrote The Physiology of Taste, he says that for the best gastronomical experience, courses should proceed from the heaviest to the lightest. So you should eat a salad after a steak, not before. So right. I will say your position is defensible, but I don't think that that's traditional Italian at all.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
But
I don't think that that's I don't think that that's the order in which I've had courses in a lot of other Italian restaurants.
It is a great idea, though. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, so I'll back off and say that instead of saying that it's inspired by Italian multi-course menus, I'll say that it was inspired by the meal that I had at Dal Billy.
Okay. Hashtag tangent.
Yeah, welcome back to the, welcome back to the explanation of the conceit. Okay.
Okay, so we have the structure of the menu. Snack, soup, salad, main, pasta, palate cleanser, dessert, after-dinner cocktail. Each of those courses is meant to, we're going to fill in a childhood memory in each of those spots.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be like a composed dish based on your childhood memory.
Right.
Each of those courses just gives us an opportunity to talk about a childhood memory that somehow fits in or somehow is inspired by the like type of course that it is.
I was worried when you first proposed it, I was worried that we were, for each of the courses, we were taking inspiration from a childhood memory, but then actually making it into the type of food that you would see in a 8-course dinner menu. And I was, that sounded like a lot of work.
It sounds like a lot to explain.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's just
if,
like,
it would, if we had to talk about it,
it would be too much.
It would be too much.
But there is, have you ever heard of there's a famous dish from Osteria Francescana in Modena, and it's called Memory of a Mortadella Sandwich?
No.
And it's kind of, it's that, what we just described, like it's, he is taking kind of the components and flavors of a mortadella sandwich, which was one of his childhood favorites. And yeah, reimagining it as Massimo Bottura does, like in a modern, crazy modernist sense. So there's like a mortadella, I don't know, it comes out of a siphon, like a mortadella puff or something. It looks like a cloud, pink cloud. It's like a mortadella foam. I'm not using the right word. I don't know what it's called. Like this little line of crushed pistachio. And I can't remember what the bread component is, but it's, I was worried we were doing stuff like that.
Well, if we're going to do that, we should do it as a meal instead of as a podcast.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. 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 That would be much more compelling, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And how are you feeling about your selections, Alan? Are you feeling pretty, you feel like you got a good cross section of childhood food memories? Do you feel like you had to leave any big ones off the table?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And actually now that I'm looking over it, there's not very much, I don't know if there's any restaurant representation, like eating out in restaurants as a child. So it's all home. It's all home cooked stuff. There's quite a bit of, kind of like convenience foods and stuff. We should just start.
Yeah, let's just get into it. Do you want to go first?
Sure.
Okay.
Snack. Okay, so this would not be appropriate as an hors d'oeuvre or anything in a restaurant, but I ate it almost every day as a child. Bologna sandwich with ketchup on white bread. Mm-hmm. That was my lunch in elementary school, and when we needed a quick snack on the weekend or whatever, that's what my mom was making. I can't say that I've purchased bologna in a long time, but I do buy mortadella I do make sandwiches with it. I usually make it with mustard now, but back in the day, it was bologna and ketchup.
Bologna and ketchup. Nice. Butter? Margarine?
No. However, no. Okay, so I ate that for lunch at elementary school every day. My mom would make it in the morning. She also made my dad a sandwich in the morning for him to take to work. And his sandwich was peanut butter and Miracle Whip.
Oh, yeah. Which is, I've heard tell of this sandwich.
Really? From me or?
It must be from you. I can't. But I don't know.
If there's someone else who eats that, I need to meet them. That was my dad's sandwich. And I need to try it again. But as a child, I thought it was quite gross. Like, to eat anything besides jelly with peanut butter was very strange. But one day in the morning when the lunch boxes were being packed up, the sandwiches got switched. And so I took a huge bite into my, what I thought was a bologna sandwich, but it was a peanut butter and Miracle Whip sandwich. Even when that happens, it's always jarring. Like when you're expecting one flavor and you get another, even if the new flavor, the surprise flavor is like totally palatable and delicious, but this was like it was traumatic. Actually, it was
like you can still remember how awful it was.
Yeah, the tanginess of the Miracle Whip with the peanut butter was so off-putting to me as a child.
Yeah, but it sounds shocking.
Yeah,
Miracle Whip especially It's got a real special tang. Okay, well, I'm interested in trying that at some point, peanut butter and Miracle Whip.
I had a friend who would have peanut butter and pickle sandwiches, so I think, like, I can see peanut butter and something savory and acidic going well together now as a grown-up, but yeah, as a child, you're very particular, and you have very specific ideas of what foods go together, so.
Well, and I still do feel the same way about peanut butter and jam. I mean, like, I, you know, those two things are so nestled together in my head.
Yeah.
It's like really hard to separate them, honestly.
But that's, and I don't know if this is like the time or the place or whatever where I grew up, but like peanut butter was only for toast and sandwiches. But then once, I don't know, I moved to a bigger city and, you know, the Food Network revolution happened. And then you realize, like, you start tasting, like, say the peanut sauce, like that's served with salad rolls and stuff like that, or satay. And, you see peanut pastes and stuff like that in different situations. You realize that it's actually quite versatile and it doesn't just need to be, toast and sandwiches and peanut butter parfaits and stuff. But
there's no peanut butter in a peanut butter parfait.
Sorry. I mean the peanut flavor.
Yeah, no, yeah, I hear you. Okay, so snack course.
Yeah.
My snack is a single raw shrimp that I ate. Well, actually, it was live. Let me back up. when I was little, going into my teen years, I think, like verging on my teen years, we had some family friends who had a cabin on Gambier Island, which is an island just off the coast of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And often during the summer, we would go and stay with them for a week and stay at their cabin. And there was a few like amateur fishermen who would go out during the day and set crab traps and shrimp traps. And one day we were hanging out on the dock, and this fisherman came in with his boat, and he had a shrimp trap full of, I can't really remember. I mean, I didn't know the difference between types of shrimps back then. Mm-hmm. But I would have to imagine that they were spot prawns, because that's most of what you catch on just off the coast. Mm-hmm. So he had a whole trap full, like, I don't know, probably a couple hundred shrimps. And he gave one to each, my brother and I, and while they were still alive. And we, like, broke the heads off them and took the meat out of the tail and ate the meat, like, raw. That was the first time I'd ever eaten raw fish of any kind. Mm-hmm. And it was just such a crazy experience. Because, you know, obviously we thought that we couldn't eat that, but the fisherman guy, I forget what his name was. Damn. I wish I could remember. But yeah, he told us that it was fine. He did it in front of us.
Oh, really?
They're like, okay. So then we tried one. And I mean, it was pretty overwhelming as an experience. I don't really remember the flavor of it that much. Mm-hmm. Like, the flavor of it isn't visceral so much as the experience of doing it.
Right.
But yeah, I'll never forget that. And I mean, raw shrimp is one of my favorite types of sushi and sashimi to eat. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, it's amazing. It's so sweet and delicate, and yeah, it's amazing.
Was it difficult to muster the courage to rip the shrimp open, or did that come fairly easily?
I think after seeing him do it, it was pretty easy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know, the actual eating of it took a little bit of guts, but I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to look like a coward.
Right.
In front of my brother and stuff, so I just did it. And him likewise. And then we both like challenged, like, then we both looked at each other and like, did you like it?
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah, so that's my snack, and I still like raw shrimp to this day.
And then, would you serve a live shrimp in a restaurant and have and force the customer to do that?
No.
Okay.
No. Just because I'm sure that it would be a challenging experience for a lot of people.
Yeah.
However, like when I was working in a restaurant on the Sunshine Coast, we would charter, well, not charter, but like basically hire half of, you know, like fishermen who were going out to catch spot prawns. We would just pay them in advance for like half of their catch. Mm-hmm. So that we could buy them directly from the boat, so we could get really good deals on them. And then we could have like, you know, we could make a dish that has, because spot prawns are pretty expensive. And so we could make a dish that had a lot on it and still have it be relatively cost effective.
Right. Yeah.
And so we would get like just like pounds and pounds and pounds and pounds of live shrimp and just have to behead them all. Mm-hmm. And I dare say that having that experience in my youth, like, made it much less of a hurdle for me to get over, like when we started doing that in the restaurant.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I was prepared, I guess, thinking that they don't really have much of a nervous system.
Is that true?
That's what I've read. I don't know. It's hard to know, right? Mm-hmm. Shrimps don't really tell you what's going on. So
what's your soup?
Okay. Next course. Soup course. My soup is not a soup. It's
you're cheating.
Milk from, what's that?
You're cheating. I'm just kidding.
I know. Yeah, I'm totally cheating. Most of my things are not the thing that they're supposed to be. My soup is milk from the bowl of Alphabits that I would have at my grandma's house when we went to visit my grandma.
Okay.
And grandpa. So, for family holidays and religious holidays and things like that, we would go and often stay with my grandma and grandpa, who lived in Lacombe. Mm-hmm. My mom's originally from Red Deer. They had a farm out there. But yeah, my grandparents lived in Lacombe by the time I was around. And so we would go and stay there, and we never had sugared cereal. Well, we rarely had sugared cereal at home, mm-hmm. In our place. But my grandma and grandpa always had a larder full. So there were lots of varieties, but for some reason, I don't know. I think when I was quite young, I gravitated towards the Alphabits, probably because I could like mess around and spell things or something. I don't know.
Yep.
But yeah, I just like the cereal milk from sugared cereal, and especially from the Alphabits, is something that, you know, I still think about pretty often, watching cartoons and drinking Alphabits cereal milk. That's like, if I could offer that as a course in a meal that I was presenting to somebody,
right,
I think that I could make them really happy.
So you're an ice cream man.
Yeah.
Have you ever gotten to have the cereal milk ice cream from Milk Bar?
I have had it. Yeah? Yes.
You like it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we also at Kind have used cereal milk flavoring for a couple of our flavors.
Mm. Yeah. And do you actually use cereal to make it?
Yeah, yeah. Use cornflakes, which I'm pretty sure is the same thing that they use at Milk Bar, or at least for some of their cereal milk things, they use cornflakes to flavor it.
Okay, well, I had a really literal interpretation of soup and a fairly mundane answer. So I'm going to change it up a little bit.
Nice.
Kind of inspired by your cereal milk. So my soup now is wild blueberries from Ontario with in a bowl with brown sugar and milk.
Oh my God, yes.
And so my mom's family is from around Sudbury, which a lot of people in Ontario call Northern Ontario, even though it's, you know, within an hour's drive of the American border. So
did your last name used to be Sudbury before you went through Ellis Island?
No, I think, but they are actually related, like linguistically, Sudeby and Sudbury, and I think Sutheby as well, all more or less mean Southern village or something like that. Don't quote me on that. But so driving up, like through the Canadian Shield in that part of Ontario in the summer, there's always people selling wild blueberries on the side of the road, and usually in those like green cardboard cartons. So we would buy those, and then when we would get to my grandma's place, we'd put them in a bowl with milk and brown sugar, and I guess, yeah, eat it kind of like you would cereal. But it's a good, like the wild blueberries, like the teeny tiny ones, Really sweet, really delicious. And then the little pop of those berries in the milk and some of the undissolved sugar in the bottom of the bowl. That's a good memory.
That's a good one. Okay. Moving on. Next course. Third course, salad.
I struggled with a few of the categories, but usually I struggled in like I had a surfeit of memories and ideas, but the salad one, like I don't remember eating a salad, like a green salad before I was in high school for sure. So I had to go a different salad. There was, I feel like every time I sat down for supper in the summertime, especially with my dad's family, there was always three types of mayonnaise bound salads on the table. There was potato salad, macaroni salad, and cabbage salad.
Yeah.
And they're all like all in mayonnaise. And I actually like them quite, especially the macaroni. So we'll talk about this from the past. I love macaroni, but my recollection is like elbow macaroni in mayonnaise with like celery and maybe little cubes of ham and little cubes of orange cheddar, and minced onion. So that was those salads. I just remember eating constantly in the summer.
Yeah, actually, I'm surprised that it never occurred to me. Because, yeah, I think I ate a lot of potato salad when I was young, too. Mm. And I really love potato salad. But, it didn't occur to me for some reason. But, yeah, my salad course is going to be a whole tomato eaten like an apple. So I don't remember. So I have this memory, and it's, like, really visceral. But I don't remember who I was with when it happened. Mm-hmm. But I was with a friend from school, I think, and I was at their house and we were just like hanging out playing games or something. I don't know what we were up to. I think maybe I'd gone there after school for some reason. Maybe my parents were doing something and I went to my friend's house after school, until they could pick me up, something like that. I don't exactly remember. We got to his house and, he was like, oh, do you want like something to eat? And I was like, oh, sure. And he was like, do you want a tomato? And I was like, what? And yeah, he like handed me a tomato and then he picked up, he picked up a tomato. They had them on the counter in a bowl. Mm-hmm. I remember. And he just like bit into it like an apple and then he put a little bit of salt on it.
Oh, that's nice.
And then bit into it again, and it ate the whole thing like an apple. And that's what I did as well. And I was just like, my mind was blown. The only tomato I'd ever had was either, like cut up in some kind of like salad preparation or cooked like as a sauce or, like maybe tomatoes, like maybe wedges, like maybe the most like whole tomato I'd ever eaten was like in wedges.
Yeah.
He showed me that you could just eat a tomato like an apple and put a little bit of salt on it. And it was like amazing.
That's great. Especially the name of the course, a tomato eaten like a whole apple. Or sorry, is that what it was?
Eaten whole like an apple or something like that. Yeah.
That sounds like the kind of language and presentation that you would get at a place like Favakin or something. If you read your books and their menus, it's like the name of the dish on the menu is like a fish served on the kelp that it lives near. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. A duck spin roasted beside a fire for 46 hours.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's kind of funny because it's like, it's accidentally like that or something. But yeah, the tomato was so good. I don't know. They must have been from my friend's garden or something like that. But yeah, the tomato was amazing. Mm-hmm. And actually, like I really do, unlike with the shrimp, I really do viscerally remember the flavor of that tomato. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it could be that maybe it was like the first time I had tasted a tomato with just salt on it or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I just remember it being so delicious and so flavorful and sweet and acidic and just, really good. And so now like I hold up tomato flavors to my recollection of that flavor. Like I'm constantly chasing that dragon.
Yeah, it's a high compliment to a tomato to be able to eat it that way.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and that might have been part of it. It was just that it was just such a good tomato or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't often eat tomatoes like that now, but I kind of think about it all the time. Mm-hmm. Like when I see like a really nice looking tomato, mm-hmm. I often think about just like taking a bite out of it. Okay, moving on. Course number four, the main event, main course. Okay, well, my main's kind of dumb, but whatever. my main is a medium rare steak.
Okay.
So,
tell me more.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty broad. I don't know. I just like, I have these memories. This one for me, like you were saying earlier that you don't have like a lot of restaurant representation in your menu or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a ton either, but this is definitely a little bit of restaurant representation because my parents used to take me out to eat quite a bit when I was younger. Mm-hmm. They used to take us out, me and my siblings. But yeah, like I remember there was a period of time when I was pretty young, like I must have been like 7, 8, 9 in that area or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, you know, I was able to just order a steak every time we went to a restaurant.
Right.
But certain times when we went to restaurants, it was a special occasion or something, I was allowed to order steak. And I knew that the best way to order steak was medium rare. Mm-hmm. And I knew that that was like meant that it was like still pink inside.
Right. Yeah.
And I felt like a real connoisseur.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Ordering it. Yeah. And I felt like I really, you know, had a handle on what my preferences were.
Right.
As it, you know, as it pertains to, you know, eating steak in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so I always felt like, you know, really informed and really proud that I could like order a steak.
Right.
You
know, yeah. Yeah.
The best way that it's supposed to be served. And so yeah, that's a lot. I remember that a lot from going to restaurants when I was young, like knowing that that the steak was supposed to be medium rare and telling the waiter that I wanted my steak medium rare.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think a lot of the time they were bad steaks.
Right.
Although sometimes they were probably good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's just one of my restaurant food memories from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Being so proud of ordering a medium rare steak.
And that's like I mean, that's really charming from a child's perspective. Like it's kind of like you get to do something that you probably considered quite adult, like to,
right.
Yeah. Tell exactly. The waiter how you want your steak done.
Yeah.
And there's lots of moments like that where like you, when you first start to learn about food, where you, what am I trying to think of? Like you, like if you have oysters, you want to ask where the oysters are from, or like you, I don't know. I can see it going down a path like towards snobbery and stuff. But yeah, I remember there was actually, I think this is the same thing. Like I remember being really excited. The first time that I had a Reuben, it was in a diner in Brockville, Ontario. And I saw it on the menu and said like it sounded good, but I thought it was so cool that you could just order something called a Reuben and it implied corned beef and sauerkraut and Swiss cheese and all and Russian dressing and all.
Right.
And it sounds kind of dumb that I'm saying it now, but at the time I was like, that's cool. It's like this part of, this little bit of knowledge of grown up knowledge that like, if you just say that word, it means all these things.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I that's exactly the same sort of thing. It's like, yeah, it's a little bit of secret knowledge. As a kid, you feel like empowered once you have that, you know, like once you discover something like that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So what's your main, Alan?
Mine is Christmas dinner without the turkey.
Oh, I mean, that's a good main. That's a lot of food for a main. That's good.
I don't dislike turkey, but I've always I'm way more of a starch freak than a meat guy. And so Christmas dinner was really gratifying. It really gave me what I wanted. Like I could have the like buttered dinner roll and the mashed potatoes and the stuffing. I was like, my favorite part of the plate, bar none, was always the stuffing.
Yeah, me too. For a lot of, like, I don't know, it kind of flip-flopped back and forth between mashed potatoes and stuffing for me. Yeah. But like, yeah.
And I think my mom and my aunt both told me that when I was little, I actually called it stuff and bread. Like, I didn't call it dressing or stuffing. I call it stuff and bread. So my plate would be half stuffing with mash, with gravy, a kind of like polite but perfunctory bit of turkey, and the buttered roll. For fancy meals, whether it's turkey or Christmas or Easter or whatever, my mom would always put out little platters that had, it was always like marble slices of marble cheddar and little sweet pickles like cornichon and cranberry sauce. Mm-hmm. They were like our like little banchan, like our little our condiment tray kind of. So yes, mostly stuffing with like cranberry sauce and gravy and pickles and stuff like that. That was that would be my main.
Sweet. Yeah, that's a great main. My main's kind of lacking in anything except for the meat component.
And mine's mostly starch, so.
Yeah, all right, so we'll put them together. Just take the little bit of turkey off your plate and put a medium rare steak on there. Yeah.
Actually, I've had a lot of conversations about stuffing with a friend of mine because it's, what is it? People, like, everybody's mother makes it so differently, I think. And there's mm-hmm. this kind of like spectrum of texture and consistency where there's ones that are much more cohesive, almost like some of them you could even slice like a meatloaf. And then there's ones that are more like loose and crumbly. Do you know what I mean? And all the components stay distinct.
Yeah.
What was your mom's like?
I think for the most part is like fairly compact. Mm-hmm. And I know that they used to actually stuff the bird.
Yeah.
Like when we would have those types of meals at my grandma on my mom's side's place, mm-hmm. they would actually stuff the bird. I think they would make additional stuffing outside the bird,
yeah.
but they would actually stuff the bird. And I think that I like the stuffing that came out of the bird better because it was like more moist and kind of compact, like mm-hmm. more like a bread pudding. Well, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but.
Yeah, I can picture
it. Yeah. Yeah. Like a dense bread pudding mm-hmm. rather than like, yeah, like kind of loose, falling apart, kind of like
right.
crouton-y type of situation.
There's just not enough space inside a turkey to make enough stuffing though.
No, exactly. You always need more than that. And then so that like that's how I make mine now is I try to make it sort of in a way that I would make a bread pudding. Like
yeah.
I use all the ingredients that my mom told me that she used to put in hers. Mm-hmm. And so I try to make it taste like hers, except I probably add way more, like I add a bunch of fresh herbs and stuff, which mm-hmm. probably doesn't make it taste exactly like how it used to taste, mm-hmm. but I can't really remember anymore. So I'll tell you something about stuffing, Alan.
Okay.
I was like, it was during the Food Network revolution, as you put it, or whatever, that I think that I realized for the first time that people would stuff their turkey or whatever with something other than like what we would conventionally call stuffing or dressing.
Okay.
Like with sausage or with like nuts and berries or like all kinds of other things. Mm-hmm. I was just like, what? mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, whenever we make a holiday meal, always still make like bread stuffing.
Yeah.
Okay, a whole meal for your main. I get it.
I'd portion it appropriately, but...
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, next course, pasta.
Pasta. So I just realized that I have macaroni twice on my menu. Nice. My macaroni salad. but the single most important meal to me as a child was macaroni and cheese. Mm-hmm. And I maybe have told you this before, I can't remember, but when my mom grew up Catholic, and when she was growing up in the 50s and 60s, Catholics couldn't eat meat on Fridays.
Yikes.
And so her aunt, who always, like her aunt did all the cooking in her house when she was growing up, she would always make as their meatless supper on Friday, mac and cheese and fish cakes, because fish don't count. Fish don't count as meat.
Right, because fish isn't meat, yeah, obviously, exactly. According to the lore.
It's actually like, it's like basically medieval, like the dietary laws are based more in medieval folklore than like the words of Christ. But
right. You mean like it was co-opted by the church because people were already doing that and the church wanted to like not have to upset all of their regular...
I should have read this. I should have looked into
like,
this.
You know, before, you know, but... how like religious holidays are, you know, based around, you know, old,
yeah, like pagan celebrations,
old, like Celtic or Druidic holidays, yeah, and things like that in Western civilization, because the church didn't want to force everyone to stop celebrating. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This one's more like the reasoning that they give behind fish being okay to eat on Fridays had more to do with, like the medieval or like the old, ideas of the tempers, and fish was, because it lived in cold water, it didn't have the same effect on the body as the flesh of land animals and stuff like that.
Right.
I'm out of my depth right now. What I want to talk about is mac and cheese. So that's what she ate every Friday growing up. But then
mac and cheese and fish cakes.
Yeah. Like from canned salmon. Mm-hmm. And then in, I think, 1965 or something like that, there was the Second Vatican Council, which got rid of that rule, more or less. Mm-hmm. So you could eat meat on Fridays, but the tradition persisted in her home through to when I was a child. And so when I came home from Friday or from school on Friday, we had mac and cheese. And sometimes on like particular days, like Good Friday or something, we'd also have fish cakes. But I, like I mentioned, I'm a starch freak and a cheese freak. So it was delicious to me to begin with, but it also like had the, it became all bound up with Friday evening, like the weekend, right, for me. So yeah, that's probably my single greatest set of food memories is eating mac and cheese with a good
mac and cheese on Fridays.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking about like, yeah, elbow, like homemade mac and cheese with elbow macaroni and made with like yellow cheese probably. And...
yeah. Made probably with marble cheddar. Mom's was a little different. She didn't make like a cheese sauce. It was cooked in tomato sauce, but had a cheese gratin top on it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was just going to ask you like what the topping was, but I guess the cheese was the topping.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that for my mom, the topping was just a straight like crusty cheese gratin. I had at least one aunt who I'm pretty sure put cracker meal on top as well with the cheese for a little extra crunch, but mm-hmm, yeah.
Was there cheese mixed in with the tomato? Because to me, honestly, Alan, tomato and elbow macaroni with cheese on top doesn't really sound like mac and cheese. It sounds like baked like
pasticcio
macaroni.
yeah, fair enough. And actually when I make it for myself now, I do make like, I guess, a Mornay sauce. Like I'll make a roux with milk and add cheese, so I have a cheese sauce. But no, that's just not what my mom did, not what Aunt Dory did, so I'll stand by it.
Fascinating. Okay, well, my pasta course is not pasta.
Of course.
It's pizza. yeah, we used to go, I mean, kids love pizza, and I loved pizza when I was a kid, mm-hmm, and we used to go to a pizza shop in Spruce Grove called Peter's, mm-hmm, which...
you don't know if it exists.
I want to say that maybe it does. I don't know. It's weird. Like, I think I ate there not that long ago, like within the last like 5 or 6 years. I think it still was open or had been reopened like that. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, we used to go there a fair amount when I was a kid, and they had a jukebox. I would always get to go play some songs. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just like that regular, like pizzeria style pizza. Like it's like a thick crust kind of thing, but you know, like a pan pizza, yep, basically. Yep. Same kind of pizza that you would get at like Boston Pizza or something like, mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. Boston Pizza, there also was one of in Spruce Grove. It was kind of like a big deal out there, actually. Yep. But yeah, we would eat at Peter's quite a bit. And I just, yeah, I don't know. Pepperoni and mushroom, that's my jam.
Yeah, the flavor of pepperoni is an important childhood memory for sure. Yeah. Like it's inextricable from, I had never heard of a margarita pizza until whenever Earl's put it on a menu. I had never heard of a margarita pizza.
Totally.
But yeah, pizza meant pepperoni to me when I was a kid.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, lots of my friends also loved ham and pineapple. Mm-hmm. There was a fair amount of that around. I used to not like ham and pineapple. I used to like really think that it was weird to have fruit on your pizza. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I didn't like the flavor of the hot fruit.
Right.
But since we're so close to it right now, anyways, I'm just gonna unburden myself a little bit. My favorite set of pizza toppings now is pepperoni and pineapple.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
How does the pineapple get on the pizza? Is it just like, it's just cubes of pineapple raw on the pizza? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, raw, but cooked when the pizza is cooked, like not fresh after the pizza comes out of the oven. Mm-hmm. I also really love fresh tomato on my pizza. So sometimes I'll have pepperoni and pineapple pizza, but then I'll slice up my own tomato. Like if I order a pizza to come to my house, or if I make a pizza at home, then yeah, I'll just like grab cherry tomatoes or a tomato from the fridge and just, you know, like make slices of tomato and put a slice on each piece.
Why? Just a fresh component.
I don't know. Yeah, there's just something like the tomato still being cool and also being kind of, the freshness of it kind of cuts the richness of everything else that's on the pizza. For me, it just like, just elevates.
Fair enough. We do I think that this was actually inspired by something that Three Boars used to do. Three Boars used to have, I think it was an oca and caramelized onion tart.
Uh-huh.
It's like a savory cheese and onion tart. And I don't know if it was always served this way, but when I had it there, they brought it out to the table and they put what looked like just like this massive mound of arugula down. Mm-hmm. Like that's what the plate, it would just look like I started to tell them actually we had ordered the tart, not the salad or whatever. But the tart was buried under all of the greens. And so you eat it, it's like a very rich tart, but then you're having just like fistfuls of greens with some kind of simple dressing on them as well. And it was so fun to eat. Like it was really great. And so that's kind of how I tend to make my pizza at home. Or sorry, like how I eat my pizza at home is what we'll make. I usually have whatever ham and bell pepper and whatever. So we don't have pepperoni on hand often. And then just like, yeah, a mountain of arugula with olive oil and cheap balsamic vinegar on it.
Yeah.
And yeah, eat it all. It all goes in the mouth at the same time.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, I think pizza can really use something like that. Something fresh and yeah, like vegetal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's the pasta. Moving on, palate cleanser.
So wait, why? How come you get to say pizza for pasta? Because it fills the same starch and
yeah. Because pizza is basically pasta.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's starch and tomato sauce and cheese. Like I mean,
and
you know,
that is actually what pasta was to me until I was. Oh, actually, okay. So yeah, as a child, like pasta was only served with tomato sauce. But once we moved to Calgary, there is a restaurant there called Mercado that just like blew my mind. Like I didn't know anything about the different provinces of Italy and the different cuisines there and everything. So that was my first exposure to it. And it rocked my world.
How old were you?
Like I probably ate there for the first time when I was a teenager. Like I was probably 16.
Oh yeah.
I actually worked there briefly when I was in culinary school. But yeah, not all of their pasta comes in tomato sauce. And then of course other places like Corso, of course, taught us even more about it. So
yeah, well actually we used to go to the old Spaghetti Factory quite a bit when I was a kid. And my I don't know if he always did, but my dad tended to order the pasta a la Homer, which, if you're not familiar with the old Spaghetti Factory menu.
Homer or Omar?
No,
like it, Homer. Okay, so it's not lobster pasta.
No. Okay. Homer the poet, is that?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it had olives in it?
No, it's like plain spaghetti. Well, I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's traditionally served with spaghetti. Probably not. But it's a Spaghetti Factory, Alan. Yeah. So yeah, that's what you get. Yeah, it's spaghetti with brown butter and mozzarella, grated mozzarella cheese.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's delicious. Mm-hmm. And so I had some pretty early exposure to that, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that sort of like was the thing that where I kind of figured out that pasta didn't always have tomato sauce on it or whatever.
Oh, okay. And yeah, of course, there was lots of pasta with cream sauce. With Alfredo and
like I didn't have a ton of pasta with cream sauce, I think, when I was younger.
Yeah.
Like Alfredo to me, I don't know. I guess I was probably aware of it, but I think like I was more like, you know, what you were saying, like 16 or something when I, you know, ate in restaurants and discovered like, yeah, creamy sauce pastas. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we would have had it at home, but like at the places like Chianti and Il Forno, like that style of Italian restaurant, I would often get fusilli with cream and peas and I think salmon or something in it as well. But
Oh yeah. That's like a, what's that called? That's, can't remember what it's called. It's good though.
Okay. I just couldn't let you just breeze by and say and not explain why you're allowed to choose pizza for pasta. Yeah,
I mean, if you want me to cut it up into little strips, I can do that for you. We'll cut it up table side. Cut it into like long. We'll bring out a whole pizza and then we'll cut it into tiny little strips using a mandolin.
Speaking of cutting tiny strips off of pizza, someone that used to work with us, one of his first cooking jobs was at Boston Pizza, and he was a teenager and behaved as such. And he said that if he was hungry, when a pizza would come out of the oven, and then before they cut the wedges, they would just cut a 1-inch strip out of the middle of the pizza all the way along the entire length.
Oh my God, those little shits.
And eat it, and then just push the two half moons back together, and you can barely tell that you're missing that inch.
What a nightmare. Yeah. Oh my God. I feel like I've eaten nothing but inchless pizzas my whole life.
Yeah.
Now that I know that secret.
You're going to bring a protractor the next time you go to Boston Pizza.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, cleanser.
You're going to say something dumb like roast beef or something, right?
No. Come on. That's taking things too far, Alan.
Sorry, I interrupted. What's your palate cleanser?
Maybe horseradish would work as a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
Now that you mention it. But yeah. My palate cleanser actually wound up being quite traditional. It's a lemon sorbetto that wasn't as good as it was supposed to be. So when I was pretty young, like I must have been around 10 11, so something like that, a good friend of mine from school, Conrad, told me that they had this like amazing lemon ice at there was like this sort of Italian ice cream shop in West Edmonton Mall for a while. Don't remember what it was called. Anyway, he like raved about this lemon ice that they had there and told me all about it. Told me it was like nothing that he'd ever tasted before, and it was like so amazing. And just like tasted like sweet fresh lemons, and like was just like blew his mind, and he went on and on about it. So I like made my parents take me there to try it after a while of hearing about it. And I tried it, and he just hyped it up way too much, and it just like wasn't that good. I mean, I think it was fine. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that it was like probably a reasonably good, like it was quite tart. It was like probably a reasonably good lemon sorbetto. But like for me, you know, that just wasn't hitting the spot the way ice cream hits, you know?
Yeah.
And I was expecting it to be like a life-altering experience because he had had this like religious epiphany tasting it or whatever. And I think that like as far as like foods go, it's like one of my earliest sort of like memories of something being like something not being as good as I was hoping or expecting it to be. Yeah. And I mean, I like, you know, lemon ice now and lemon sorbet. Like, I think it's great. And it makes an excellent palate cleanser.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just remember at the time being fully underwhelmed by it.
It's hard. I mean, you want to, sometimes you have to underpromise and overdeliver.
We like what I imagine happened is that like he tasted it maybe expecting it to not be very good or something like that. And then it was like way better than he was expecting. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, oh my God, it's amazing. And you know, like it really, I don't know. It just shows how your expectation can really tailor your experience of something.
For sure.
If you, whether you're surprised by it or whether you're hoping for it to be amazing and it turns out to not be as amazing as you hoped or whatever, it can really affect your experience.
I find that a lot with traveling, like, you know, certain famous dishes or restaurants or ingredients. Sometimes the expectation or like the, like the waiting for it and wondering what exactly it's going to taste like. Sometimes that makes the experience more enjoyable, and sometimes it, you build it up too much and it disappoints. But
yeah, I find that with I find that with locations too when I'm traveling.
Oh yeah,
you know, like locations that people have hyped up, or you know, tourist things that people have hyped up, and
totally.
And then you go there and you're like, well, maybe I'm not seeing the same charm that that person saw, right, or something. Yeah. You know,
I struggled with palate cleanser. But what I came up with actually has a similar flavor profile to yours, maybe. But my palate cleanser is a bottle of Fresca.
Oh, that's a good cleanser.
Yeah. That was, I didn't realize when I was young that that was like a low sugar, like it was an artificially sweetened pop and probably was marketed as such. I didn't know that. I just thought it was tasty and I would always get it from the, from Lakeshore variety, when we went to buy candy and stuff. But yeah, I guess it's like an aspartame sweetened pop that's just flavored with, I don't know, generic citrus, I think, like grapefruit and lime.
Which I wonder if it was always flavored with aspartame or whether that formulation changed at some point or something. Cause I remember having it when I was young and enjoying it before I knew about aspartame, but maybe, I don't know, maybe it came out at the advent of aspartame or something. And maybe they weren't really using aspartame to make diet versions of every other soda on the market at that time or something.
Right.
I'm not quite sure.
But, like, this would have been before Coke Zero and stuff for sure.
Right.
I did look, okay. So in my memory, I swore that there was salt in the ingredients list for Fresca. So I wanted to quickly look that up before we talk, and I don't find any evidence of that anywhere, but I did see that the sweetener has changed in it. So it came out in the 60s, and it was sweetened with something that ended up being banned by the FDA, and so it was later replaced by aspartame. I have no idea what year or even what decade that would have been, but it definitely had aspartame in it when I drank it. And I liked it a lot as a child, but now actually I haven't had Fresca in a long, long time, but like I notice now when something has aspartame in it, like it does not have the same neutral flavor as, white sugar or corn syrup or anything. So,
I definitely can pick out aspartame. I don't know if I can, like, to me, aspartame and sucralose have very similar kind of,
okay, yeah.
I don't know, flavor.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could tell the difference between the two of those.
Right.
But I can definitely pick out artificial sweeteners easily over sugar.
Yeah. So I don't know if I would still like it, but I did. That was like, it's a sleepover, like, and so we're going to go to the candy store, and I would always have Fresca. So I don't know where my salt memory came from, but yeah, I thought for sure that it had salt in it, but not in the ingredients list.
Must be some kind of sodium in the ingredients list. No,
there would be that sodium EDTA preservative probably. But so dessert was by far the hardest one to parse and choose only one memory, because so many of my right. childhood memories were food memories had to do with sweets.
Right.
And we'll just have to come back to it. I really want to just like rattle off a whole bunch, but we'll just stay focused mm-hmm. and disciplined. So I'm going to say,
okay.
My mom's coconut vanilla double layer cake. She made different, she had two main cakes that she would make, for birthdays and special occasions. And I think everyone else in my family preferred chocolate cake. So for my brother and sister and father's birthdays, she would make chocolate cake. But I liked her. She had a coconut cake that was like a really like dense, buttery, but tender crumb with coconut in it, like shredded sweetened coconut. And then it was a double layer with like a really beautiful, I don't know if it's a royal icing, but like a very white icing, like made with lard. And yeah, there's not much else to say about, but it had such great, rich mouthfeel, and the flavor and the texture of the shredded coconut. It was, yeah, probably my favorite dessert, as a kid.
Do you still get to have it sometimes?
Oh no, not really. I can't remember the last time I had it. Yeah. Because like most of our, because we live in different cities now, she lives in Calgary and I'm in Edmonton. Say if we're like, we visit at Christmas, but then at Christmas, there's like a whole other series of desserts that we have traditionally. And if we get together, yeah, same thing, like say with Easter or whenever, they always seem to be, yeah, there's other dessert traditions that need to be followed. But
okay, well, I'm looking at my two desserts that I have here, and I'm not satisfied with either of them. So I'm swapping them both out for a late entry. Contender just showed up. And just slotted his way in. So I don't know if this is going to hold up, but I may regret this. But I'm changing my whole idea right now as we speak. Wow. My dessert is a 10-finger Kit Kat bar eaten in the back of a car at a drive-in theater.
A 10-finger Kit Kat bar?
Yeah. Have you ever seen those?
No.
They're like, it's like a Kit Kat bar, but it's in a really long package. Yeah. And instead of having four fingers, it has 10.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, I remember on several occasions, like that was like kind of a share movie snack that we would get when we would go to the drive-in. Yeah, totally. Like my dad would get one of those and we would all have like some of it. Me and my mom and my dad. Like this is when I was really young. Yeah. Like when I was like four and five, and I still remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kit Kat bars, I have like a I only eat them, I always eat the chocolate off of the Kit Kat bars before I eat the wafers.
Oh my god, me too.
Are
Alan.
You serious?
Yeah, not joking at all.
Okay, so
my like Kit Kat my Kit Kat fetishism goes even farther than that, but I'll tell you after you explain what you're...
Well, okay, so I wonder if this is what you are referring to, but like when you eat Kit Kats for decades and you only ever eat the chocolate first, you notice certain things about the chocolate on the candy bar. So for instance, when you say you break a finger off and maybe the first bits of chocolate that you eat are from the two small ends of the finger. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
There's always one piece of one end that has much thicker chocolate than the other.
Yes.
Have you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And so the end with the thicker chocolate, it's much easier to get the chocolate off in one piece
exactly
than it is
For the thin one, you end up taking some of the wafer with you. But for the thick end chocolate, it just pops off.
Yeah. Well, and that also, like, when you break it, like, there's, I mean, if it's an end piece, then, you know, like, the one side of it always has, like, you know, a fully intact, like, layer of chocolate on the outside of it. But when you break it, there's usually, like, it leaves more chocolate on either the piece that's still connected to the bar or the piece that you're about to eat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that affects how you get the chocolate off the off the bar as well, like off the outside before you eat the wafer. This is ridiculous. But yeah, no, even further than that, Alan, is that like Kit Kat bars, well, it's like a really delicate milk chocolate that they use, and it melts really easily. And so I find also, like, if it's not cold or you're not eating it outside or something like that, that while I'm taking the time to eat the chocolate off the outside, like, of the bar before I eat the wafer, there's also the section that I'm holding in my hand, like between my fingers, melts as well. So then I eat the chocolate off the outside, and then I eat the wafer, and then I have to lick the chocolate off my fingers. And so it's always in that order. Yeah. I haven't eaten a Kit Kat bar in a while, but yeah, I have a whole ritual. And I really can trace it back to that, like eating Kit Kats in the back of the car at the drive-in movie. Like, I don't know, Kit Kats have always had kind of like, I mean, I like lots of different kinds of candy bars, but Kit Kats seems like sort of a kind of a plain selection in comparison to a lot of other things. But yeah, I don't know. I always had a soft spot for it, and I'm pretty sure that's why.
Yeah, it doesn't have all the glamorous toffee and caramel and...
No, it's very simple, and you eat it in small pieces, and
it's classy.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
if a chocolate bar can be classy, I would categorize Kit Kat that way.
Of course, a chocolate bar can be classy.
Oh yeah, like your Lindt dark chocolate bars that you make the s'mores out of. Super classy. Yeah. Oh yeah. Hey, Alan. Next time you go to make s'mores, just skip a step and buy the Lindt bar that has sea salt already in it.
But then I can't control the salt content.
I'm just kidding. Of course. Yeah. Obviously, you're still going to put more salt on it anyways.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously, they're not using Malden in those bars. So
no, but I think the salt is quite good in those bars. Yeah. Yeah, it's like flaky, I think.
I'm fascinated to know what your after-dinner cocktail, what your childhood memory that can be described as an after-dinner cocktail is.
Yeah, well, there's only one thing that really fits here. And I hadn't really actually thought about it when I put after dinner cocktail on the like list of courses that we should have. But really, there's only one thing that can go here, and that's a Shirley Temple. Because I used to drink them all the time whenever we used to go to restaurants when I was a kid. And I thought it was just the most special treat ever.
Yeah.
We get to go out for dinner, and then I get to order a Shirley Temple, and yeah. And so my after-dinner cocktail is a Shirley Temple.
So why do you think it was... So yeah, I don't know if how often I got them, but I know that every time we went to Smitty's for pancakes, I would get a Shirley Temple. Why do you think it was more special to you than like canned pop? Is it because you're in a restaurant and someone's built it for you, or...
Honestly, like, it's a little bit of that, but I think it's mostly the psychology of what you were talking about with the Reuben.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like a secret code word that you can say, and then someone's going to pour Sprite into orange juice for you, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's basically it. You know, like, it was this little special thing that I knew, and I knew that I could order it, and they had it on every friggin' restaurant menu when I was a kid. So, yeah, I could just order a Shirley Temple. And, I mean, they're delicious.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Or they were. I haven't had one in quite a while.
Oh, really? We kind of just talked about this, or we talked about this recently, but like we had them at June's Delicatessen. We had the idea. I don't think that they still offer them. I'm not even sure if we offered them by the time I left, but to kind of go hand in hand with the idea of the New York deli, like had these images of like a soda, like a soda fountain or like a soda parlor in my mind. Right. And we were using
You also had an egg cream on the menu, exactly, which is a very New York soda.
So you had egg cream and and a Shirley Temple that did not sell very well.
I can imagine that it wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Was there anything special about the Shirley Temple, or was it just like
it was pretty classic. Like it was orange juice and seltzer and grenadine.
And a maraschino cherry?
Yeah, and an amarina cherry. Yeah.
Oh, that is way special.
Yeah.
I was wondering about that. So, okay. So you weren't using the syrup from the amarina cherry jar instead of grenadine, or?
No, I think we had Rose's brand grenadine. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's classic. Or is your after dinner cocktail also a Shirley Temple Ale?
No, this is okay. So this is kind of a joke, but actually not really. So if you'll allow me the kind of wiggle room to say, like, this isn't about food memories, but about taste memories.
Oh yeah. I mean, it would be pretty silly of me now to be a stickler about wiggle room, Alan.
Exactly. Yeah.
After
Mr. Pizza has passed over here. Okay, so do you know what Triminic is?
That old cough syrup with the kid on it? With the, stick figure?
Yeah, that's right. I don't think that's how it's branded anymore, but in the 80s and 90s, it had like a kind of like a stick figure on it. Triminic is a series of medicine for children. They had different colors.
Totally.
There was a red one that I was told was for if you had a cough. There was an orange one if you had a runny nose. And there was a yellow one that we never had, but it's some kind of expectorant. So I don't remember tasting that one. But the
was there a purple one too? I seem to remember there being a purple one, but that's probably maybe just something I made up.
I don't know. I haven't reviewed the product line in a long time, but in my house we always had a red one and an orange one. And I hated the flavor of the red one, but I actually really liked the flavor of the orange one, to the point that one time when I was 3 or 4, I climbed onto the counter and reached into the medicine cabinet and drank right from the bottle.
Nice.
And my mom caught me and called poison control. And they said, like, it asked, how much I had drank and everything.
How much had you drank? The whole bottle?
I don't think I got that far, but
nice going, little Wayne.
Whatever the quantity I had drank was, poison control told my mom, like, he will likely fall asleep soon. And you just need to wake him up every, whatever it is, 15 minutes. It's not an emergency unless he doesn't wake up. So like he'll get drowsy and he'll fall asleep. That's fine. Just wake him up every so often. And if he doesn't, anyway, so the way,
if he doesn't wake up, then bring him to us.
I don't really remember this part, obviously, but I think the story is that we went to the park and I fell asleep while I was on the tire swing. and everything was fine. But I guess to sum up, my after dinner cocktail is an ounce of orange Triminic.
Man, that's, you could probably legit serve that in some places.
Yeah, I mean,
do they still make it?
I have no idea. I don't know, actually.
I don't like remember. I haven't remembered seeing it in quite a while, but
I was really into orange drinks. Orange Kool-Aid was my favorite color, or my favorite flavor. The McDonald's orange drink, when it existed, that's what I would get when we went through.
Does the McDonald's orange drink taste like Charmander cough syrup?
In that they both taste like artificial orange flavor, yes. But I think there's some other... Now I'm curious to try the orange Tri-Manic again, but there must be something medicinal about the flavor of the Tri-Manic.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. It looks like they do still make Tri-Manic cough syrup. It's definitely not branded the same. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Looks like it is still mostly for kids. Yeah, sadly, Alan, I don't think that you can just go to the store and buy the orange Tri-Manic anymore. It looks like the flavors and the colors have changed over the years.
Oh, interesting.
Should we check eBay?
I don't... You mean like for bottles of orange Tri-Manic from the 90s?
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me, actually. Lisa has a bottle of Orbitz that we want to put on eBay. Can you check if there's...
Oh, my God,
check if there's any... Like what the going rate for a bottle of Orbitz is?
Okay, I'll tell you right away here. By the way, there's no orange Tri-Manic on there.
That's actually probably illegal, right?
To sell cough syrup on eBay?
Yeah, is it?
I'm sure worse stuff has been sold on eBay. Okay. What kind of Orbitz are we talking about, Alan?
It's raspberry citrus.
Raspberry citrus. Okay, well, I don't see that one listed specifically on here. Most of the Orbitz are going for between $40 and $100.
Really? That's way more than I expected.
Yeah. The priciest one on here is an Orbitz pineapple banana cherry coconut natural fruit flavored beverage from the 90s, $100. It's listed at $100. I mean, I don't know if it would actually sell for that. Of the auctions that have people who are following them, it's in like the $50 range.
Okay.
There's a vanilla orange one here. It's listed at $50. There's a blueberry strawberry melon that's listed at $49.99. Somebody has their Orbitz collection on here, Alan.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. 8 bottles, all 5 flavors, 1990s nostalgia lava lamp drink, Orbitz soda collection, $210 or best offer. Man, feel like we should buy this right now. Oh, no, wait. We're trying to get rid of Orbitz, not get more.
Oh, Lisa would kill me if we sold this. Actually, what I want to do maybe for April Fool's Day... 1 year is I'll buy a bottle of Orbitz on eBay, and then I'll either like drink it or pour it down the drain river and leave the empty bottle out, and then Lisa will think that I drank her
Orbitz.
Or I could like have a situation where I take her bottle out of the drawer and hide it somewhere, and then I put the one that I purchased in the drawer, and then we like have some,
and then just take it out and drink it
and smash it or something, like take it out to show someone and then accidentally drop it and it smashes.
That's mean, but it seems like a great idea. There's also a bottle of Crystal Pepsi on here for $350, Alan.
$350.
Oh, really?
That seems expensive.
I know. Who would want that? I don't know. Somebody probably collects soda pop.
Yeah. Did you ever drink RC Cola?
Yeah.
What happened to that?
Like sometimes. What happened to it?
Yeah, is it still around?
Yeah, it's still around, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. What's the RC stand for? Royal Crown or something?
That's what I would have said, but now I'm psyched out because of like...
Because of Crown Royal? RC and CR? Yeah. I hear you. That's why I when I said it, I was like, this probably isn't right. Did you also, when you were young, did you also drink Happy Pop? Do you know what that is?
No, I don't know what that is.
Oh, what about Pop Shop? Ever heard of Pop Shop? Oh, okay. I don't know. Maybe it's an Alberta thing. But there was like this warehouse, basically, where you could go and get... I forget how it worked, but basically... you could fill a case with like glass bottles of soda. I think either they would like fill them for you, like to order or something. Mm-hmm. Or you would just like, pick out different flavors off a shelf and then you could like take home a whole case of soda. So like for like birthday parties and stuff, lots of the time when I was young, the parents or my parents would get a case of Happy Pop or Pop from the Pop Shop, and they had all kinds of weird flavors that you didn't really normally get. Like, you know, they had I don't know, like cherry, black cherry soda was like always my favorite
right.
one.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like they had all the regular flavors too, yeah. but yeah, I don't huh. know. Some like different ones. I think maybe they had a pineapple one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It was sort of like, I don't know. It's this like weird cross between something that's like totally generic, but also something that sort of has like some specialty cachet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. Huh. It's interesting. Pop Shop and Happy Pop. Okay, Alan. Well, that was a pretty good tasting menu.
Yeah. I mean, mine's not very balanced now that I'm looking at it, but.
Oh, yeah. Mine isn't either. Actually, I think.
I mean, I'd.
Well, I'm not going to say that you'd be leaving hungry after you ate mine, but. But like there's a single shrimp and like, you know, like a half a cup of cereal milk,
right.
one tomato. You know, I guess like I didn't really say how much of the pizza from Peter's you get during the pasta course. But like,
right.
if it's a whole pizza, then I guess that kind of makes up for it. It's probably three slices, I would guess. That's probably what I would eat when I was young and we would go for pizza. Two or three slices, right, yeah. I think, probably.
And three slices of pizza and like Blondie on the jukebox or something.
Oh my God, yeah. How did you know? Because I probably told you that story 100 times.
No, I just know that your first album was a Blondie one.
Yeah, my first record that I ever bought was a Blondie record. It was the best of Blondie. Mm-hmm. Well, is that technically a Blondie record or is that just a record that the record label put out? I don't know.
For our purposes, it counts.
Yeah, to me, it was a Blondie yeah. record. And yeah, the reason why was because at Peter's Pizza, we were like there one time and this song came on over like from the jukebox and it was Call Me by Blondie. Mm. And I was like shaken.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, oh, my God, this is so good. And yeah, I made my dad go and find out what it was. And then like. This must have been, I must have been in grade 3, I think, because that's when I bought that record.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that would have made me like 8 or something, 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah. And then like the very next week, I went and bought that record, saved up my allowance.
That's funny. Like I have heard that story before, except I didn't know that it took place at Peter's Pizza.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that's the entire story. Yeah, like it's all come together mm-hmm. now like a well-knit sweater. Mm-hmm. What else did you have in your dessert selections, Alan, that you were sad that you couldn't bring to the table?
Okay, so yeah, the short list for desserts. Like I had the blueberries with milk and brown sugar on there before I decided to swap it in for soup. I had the like the squares and bars platter that you get like at every church function, like Nanaimo bars, lemon bars, brownies. Date squares. I had mint chocolate chip ice cream, which is actually a restaurant memory. There was a restaurant in Oakville called the Country Squire.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always get green mint chocolate chip ice cream there. I mean, they're just scooping it out of a Breyers tub probably, but for some reason it had cachet to me. Peanut butter cookies served in an old butterscotch ice cream pail.
Oh,
that was my grandma used to make peanut butter cookies and like smash them with a fork. So you see the tines mm-hmm. on the cookie and she always stored them in old ice cream pails, like in the cupboard. So when you had to sneak in, like you're looking for the butterscotch ice cream, but there's peanut butter cookies inside.
Nice.
And then the other one was, I mentioned like one of the reasons that I don't get my coconut cake is because there's other important desserts that need to be served.
Right.
And so like at Christmas, my mom always makes a Yule log cake.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Really? Wow. Crazy.
That's
kind of a project.
Yeah.
Mine were my two desserts that I abandoned for the Kit Kat mm-hmm. thing were angel food cake,
mm-hmm.
which is just like a very, I don't know. You don't see it around anymore. Like, barely at mm-hmm. all. I mean, people are still aware of it, but yeah, like feel like no one's making it or something, but it has like such a crazy texture and like, yeah, it's so singular in terms of, Yeah, and I used to love it. Like if there was a birthday party, like my aunt used to make it, and my mom made it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think my mom made it for my birthday, or yeah, I don't know. Anytime there was angel food cake, I would just friggin' love it. And then the other thing that was on my desserts course was like anything that you get at the end of a meal that's like free. So like a mint or like a little bowl of those, like those like crappy chalky kind of mints that they would give you a little bowl of at the end of the meal.
Or those like those hard fruit candies that have the like gel inside of them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, those also. Yeah, totally. But like the king of those, the king of after meal, like you didn't order it, but we're giving it to you anyways with the bill, was a fortune cookie.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I loved me a fortune cookie when I was,
of course, yeah,
when I was a kid. That seemed super special to me. So fun. Okay, well, that was the bring out your dead round. I guess we're done now. We went way off track. We found some stuff on eBay. We came back. We did bring out your dead. Now we got to put this podcast to bed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was fun talking to you about childhood food memories, Alan. I'm sure that there's a completely other episode of childhood food memories that we can do.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm sure if we came up with another structure, I would just come up with a completely different list or whatever. Right. And
Totally.
So look forward to that. More childhood food memories coming at you some point in the future.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.